I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Jim McClelland, who has just wrapped up a 40-year career with Goodwill Industries of Central Indiana. We're going to discuss not just the accomplishments and challenges of his long tenure, but the evolution of the organization during an important period in Indiana history. Please join this conversation. You can call us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, and you can tumble upon us on Twitter at wfyi. We look forward to talking with you. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Jim McClelland, who is just retired from 41 years as president and chief executive officer of Goodwill of Central Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, Jim, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, John. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Well, how does it feel? I mean, after 40 years, first place, did it feel like 40 years?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I can't understand how this happened. You know, how does four decades go by so quickly? And yet it was something that Peter Drucker used to say that most successful careers are not planned, and mine certainly wasn't. When I was a young person, just getting out of college, if anyone had told me then that I'd be doing what I have done for the last four decades, I wouldn't have believed them at all. And yet it's been an incredible fit for somebody who's wired the way I am, and just a constant learning and growing process. And of course, the more we learn, the more we realize we don't know, and that makes us want to learn even more. And over time, the organization just evolved into something that, quite honestly, I wouldn't have even envisioned 10 years ago. So it's been an amazing time.
What drew you to Goodwill originally?
First of all, I'm a fifth generation Floridian.
Okay.
Now that's a rare species; it's seldom found this far north.
Yeah, yeah. And you guys tend to melt up here.
Freeze
and crack.
So I went to Georgia Tech. I was heavily influenced by Sputnik. Mm-hmm. You know, when the Soviets launched a satellite before we did, mm-hmm. you know, I said, "Oh, this is terrible," and I still remember the shock that mm-hmm. that so many of us had then. And I said, I'm going to be an engineer and help improve this situation. So I went to Georgia Tech and got a degree in industrial engineering, graduated at the height of the Vietnam buildup, and spent the next 3 years fulfilling my military obligation. Now, the last half of that time, I had a desk job in Washington, D.C., and I had a lot of free time. I was a young single guy, and I attended a church in downtown Washington that was heavily involved in community service. And they had a tutoring program on Thursday evenings for kids who lived in some of the low-income neighborhoods of the city, and they needed tutors. So I thought, well, I've never done anything like that, but I guess I could do that. So I volunteered. And over the course of a year, actually more than a year, I tutored two boys, 13, 14 years of age, one-on-one, mostly in math. And I got so much satisfaction from that experience, I started wondering if there was a place I could use my industrial engineering skills, get a similar kind of satisfaction, at least get paid enough to live on. And I started calling organizations that were headquartered in the Washington area, told them about my background, asked if they had any jobs for people like me. And Goodwill was one of the organizations I called, and they were interested. And make a long story short, I ended mm-hmm. up going into an executive training program that they administered It happened to be in Houston. They wanted me to train in Indianapolis, and I refused to come to Indianapolis. I wasn't going to go any place in the Midwest. And
why was that?
Because I'm a fifth-generation Floridian, and
I
didn't want to go to this part of the country. So Houston became an option, and I ended up doing that. I spent 3 years in Texas, then received a call from Indianapolis from the CEO there, who had become a friend and needed some help, and he had just found out he had cancer, unfortunately, and I came up as his vice president of operations. Unfortunately, 7 months later, he died. And 2 months after that, the board offered me the position of president CEO. And I was very young, had no idea how little I knew. And we started trying things and learning from all our experiences. And that pattern continued for 41 years. And it's been an incredible experience.
The question of how you got here has been answered, but. You know, the other part is it shows, A, you had an aversion to coming this far north originally.
Oh, yeah.
And all of that. So I would think, since you say you were pretty young at the time, that at least at that time you probably weren't thinking this was the last stop for you. What prompted you to stay?
I have had and continued to have a board of directors that allowed us to try lots of different ways of growing our businesses and accomplishing our mission. As importantly, they gave us the freedom to fail at some of what we tried and learn and grow from the experiences. And they hardly ever reminded me of the failures. And early on, I had a lot of ideas, and we started trying things. And one thing led to another, and everything that we did, particularly over the last 25 years, just built on what we had learned from earlier experiences as well as from others. And I did look at times. I looked at some of the larger markets, and I came to the conclusion that if I went to them, I would have to do over there a lot of what we had already done here. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. Let's just keep building on what we've got here and continue to make it better, continue to find new ways to enhance our mission and create more opportunities for people. And it ended up turning into a 41-year career, and Indianapolis became home.
And I want to talk about the growth of the organization, because it is spectacular. I mean, it's the revenues are, by my math, grew 40-some times over during your tenure. The number of employees grew six to seven times along the way. But I'm intrigued by what you say about how the board gave you, permission to fail and didn't hold that over your head and allowed you to grow from that experience, to learn from that. Because I think that's a message that, in our achievement-driven society, it also strikes me, it's in keeping with Goodwill's mission, too, that you can fall down, and falling down in itself is not the worst thing as long as you get back up. Can you talk a little bit about, some of the failures along the way and what you learned from them?
Yeah. I will say that we were prudent in the level of risk that we did take. We didn't bet the whole ranch on anything. And we had, not too long ago, I counted up the number of what I considered to be significant initiatives in 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of these were totally new ventures that we tried to, as a way to create more jobs for people. Some were new mission-enhancing services. Others were significant variations of something we were already doing, or just major process changes that really were more than the usual. There were 104 of these initiatives. We had a lot of singles.
Mm-hmm.
We had 18 strikeouts.
Mm-hmm.
We had 12 home runs,
mm-hmm.
but six of those were with bases loaded. and the positive impact of those home runs.
I'm guessing you're a baseball fan, but that's another story.
It seemed like kind of a good way to try to make some sense of all of this, and the strikeouts. A lot of them were efforts to create more jobs for people. Mm-hmm. See, a lot of what we do, I mean, Goodwill today employs about 3,200 people in Central Indiana. We're a major employer, mm-hmm. and that's about 1,000 more than we had 5 years ago. Two-thirds of those individuals have limited options because they have a disability, they've been convicted of a felony within the last 10 years, or they lack a high school diploma. So a big part of what Goodwill historically has done, and really the reason the organization was founded in the beginning over 100 years ago in Boston, was to provide work for unemployed people who didn't have many options. So some of the failures back in the early 80s during a deep recession when unemployment went up to about 12% in this area, we started a lot of little businesses as a way to try to keep some people employed and became, in essence, a mini conglomerate of $200,000, $250,000 a year businesses, and I still can't imagine a worse form of organization. Mm-hmm. But we did keep some people employed, and as the economy improved, we gradually got out of all those little initiatives. Then we tried a few bigger bets. We got into plastics recycling at one point, never were able to make that work. We tried to manufacture nurses' uniforms at one point for the Defense Department. That was probably the worst experience I had, and maybe the one thing that we tried that I wished we had never tried. And at one point, we went out to the northwest part of the city into an industrial park and greatly expanded space for our commercial services operation, thinking we could fill the space, and we didn't. We bit off more than we could chew. So, we had some failures like that, but nothing that that really put the whole organization in jeopardy.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Jim McClellan, who just retired from 41 years as president and chief executive officer of Goodwill of Central Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Real quickly, while we're talking about that theme, you said that the only one was the nurse's uniform that you wish you hadn't tried. The second part of my question is, what did you learn from each of them? I mean, it sounds like, with the mini conglomerate idea, the lesson was we need to be a more coherent, tightly structured organization. What were some of the other lessons from what you call the strikeouts?
I think there were times when we thought we could do just about anything, and we'll find somebody that knows that field, and we'll get in there and we'll learn how to do it. And at times we became too diversified. That was particularly true in the early 80s. And at times, there were a couple of those failures that they weren't totally our fault. One of the ventures that we started up, the company that provided the equipment never could get the equipment to work properly, and we worked with it for about a year and finally decided let's go do something else. So we learned to do our due diligence a little bit better in some cases and really look at these kinds of things more carefully before we did risk any significant amount of money.
Was it difficult? I mean, I've spent now a significant slice of my career in the not-for-profit world. And one of the challenges that I've seen along the way is getting people to understand, okay, good intentions are not enough here.
Right.
that at some level we have to execute too. It's not just good enough to be pure of heart. You really have to do something. And it sounds like you took a very business-like approach to what was a not-for-profit service, altruistic organization.
Well, throughout its history, most of Goodwill's revenue has come from the sale of products and services in a competitive marketplace. So mm-hmm. we've always been engaged in commerce as a means of accomplishing our charitable mission. And you know, when you're subject to competition on a day-to-day basis, you tend to have a little more of a sense of urgency, perhaps, and a greater drive to improve, because you know that if you don't, you know, somebody's going to be in there and they're going to eat your lunch. It keeps you on your toes, and I think it makes you improve perhaps at a faster rate than you might otherwise. But I would say, perhaps the most unique aspect of goodwill is the way and the extent to which we do blend business and mission. But I would like to talk at some point here about a little bit more about this good intention and where we ought to be headed as a sector, really.
Well, that's why we've got an hour here. We've got plenty of time. We are talking with Jim McClelland, who's just retired as president and CEO of Goodwill of Central Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Jim McClelland just after his retirement from 41 years as president and CEO of Goodwill of Central Indiana, at a time when Goodwill exploded during that 40 years, grew from 558 to 3,200 employees, and from $3 million in annual revenue to $130 million. Now the organization has 57 retail stores, e-commerce operations. Basically, it's a major player here in Central Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, before we went to the break, we were talking about how you balance the whole idea of serving what is primarily an altruistic mission with the need to establish some business-like principles. And I think the break came up on you in mid-thought, so I'm going to give you a chance here to complete the thought.
We have, for the last, 10, 15 years, articulated our overall objective in general terms as maximizing mission-related impact while maintaining a financial position that's good for our long-term viability. So we're not trying to maximize profits. We're trying to maintain a financial position, though, where we're strong enough that we can really do a good job accomplishing the mission. That you're constantly struggling to keep your head above water financially all the time. You're going to be more focused on just surviving rather than thriving and really trying to maximize your impact. And that word impact, I think, is particularly important because, as you pointed out, a lot of people, and this is particularly true when I started my career, a lot of people would support organizations like ours because the people working in them had good intentions. And then we started seeing this emphasis on what I term activity metrics. You know, how many people did you serve? Well, that really doesn't tell if you made a difference. It doesn't tell if you really had any if a person's life really was changed. It just basically says probably that you were busy doing some things that probably had some good intentions. But did you really make a difference? And then we started seeing a lot of emphasis on accountability, particularly from a financial standpoint. Mm-hmm. But really, you can be accountable for every penny you receive and spend, and still be totally ineffective. We have to be getting at What kind of impact are we really making? How many people's lives are really being changed? To what extent are their lives being changed for the better? And this is what we try to get at. And every major move that we've made at Goodwill, in I would say the last 25 years, has really been in an effort to increase long-term impact in the lives of people and the communities where we operate. And all of it has built on what we had learned from earlier experiences. It's just been a constant process.
How do you measure that challenge of figuring out, okay, did we make a difference here?
In a lot of what we do, you can actually do it in economic terms.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if we have a person who comes to us and who has been unemployed, not earning any money, and has been receiving public assistance. And we're able to assist that individual in becoming gainfully employed, reducing the amount of public support he or she requires. You can measure that. You can actually even get into return on investment metrics, how much went into that process. You know, over the last 10 years, Goodwill has actually 11 years, Goodwill has been involved in public education. In particular, over the last 5 years, through the development, the creation, and then development and growth of what we call the Excel Centers, which are diploma-granting high schools for older youth and adults who had previously dropped out. Well, there we've got individuals who did not have a high school diploma. They were not qualified in most cases for anything but the lowest paying jobs, and the vast majority of them weren't working at all. And we can help them not only get a high school diploma, but we can help them get some credential that makes them more employable. And then we can help them get into the workforce in an area, hopefully, where there are stackable credentials available, where there are career paths, and where they really can start to earn enough money to support themselves and a family. And you can quantify all of that.
We are talking with Jim McClelland as he wraps up 41 years as the president and CEO of Goodwill of Central Indiana. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, how did you identify like the Excel Centers, the educational initiatives? How did you decide what the priorities were going to be? Where, you know, because as you've demonstrated, the need is overwhelming. There, you know, it is vast, and you're not going to be able to solve all of it at once. How did you just say, oh, okay, this is the problem we're going to try to tackle now?
That process really began 25 years ago, when most of the people we worked with were adults who had disabilities. We employed a fair number, and we helped others get jobs with other firms. And then the head of the state agency that was administering what back in those days we called welfare came over to us and said, can you help welfare recipients get jobs? We said, well, let's find out. And we found out that we could, but only the lowest paying jobs, because hardly any of them had high school diplomas. But we kept doing that and actually did it for 17 years. Then in the mid-90s, what is now Employee Indy, asked us if we would be interested in operating one of the one-stop centers, which are now called Work One Centers in Indiana. And we put in a proposal to do that and ended up for 9 years running all three of the centers that were operational at the time in Marion County, and started seeing 40,000 to 50,000 unemployed people come through the doors of those centers every year. After about a year of that, we started looking at demographics and were stunned to find that 50% of them did not have high school diplomas. But we got to wondering if, as an organization, we had anything to offer young people who weren't headed in a positive direction. The thinking was that if we could help them stay in school, get a high school diploma, they'd be less likely to need our services once they became adults. We got involved in a number of small-scale initiatives, all of them with IPS. We learned a lot over a period of several years, came to the conclusion we did have something to offer, but weren't sure what we might do that would have the potential for long-term impact. Well, about that time, the Indiana General Assembly passed a charter school bill, gave the mayor of Indianapolis chartering authority. Bart Peterson had just been elected mayor, hired David Harris to set up a charter school office, develop some processes for determining who should get a charter and processes for holding them accountable. And they approached us and asked if we would consider starting a charter high school. Long story short, we did that. Started the Indianapolis Metropolitan High School about 11 years ago, and high poverty, high special needs population of students, incredible organizational learning experience. And one of the things we saw was that the older students who came to us way behind on credits, the 18 and 19-year-olds, didn't succeed. They needed a different kind of school. And through some research that we started doing in 2008, we were pretty shocked, I was at least, to find that 14.5% of the adult population of the state lacks a high school diploma. It's over 100,000 adults in Marion County alone don't have a high school diploma. We thought, wow, is there anything that we can do here that might help? So we went to the mayor's office and said, we think we have an idea here. Perhaps we can create a school, a diploma-granting high school, for older youth and adults who had dropped out. We were encouraged to do so. Long story short, we created the Excel Center, opened the first one in August of 2010 with 300 students, did no advertising after that, and 6 months later had 2,000 people on a waiting list. So over the last 4 years, added schools. There are now five in Indianapolis, one each in Lafayette, Kokomo, Anderson, and Richmond. There'll be three more opening up this year, three more next year. This past year, we operated with 2,900 students in the Excel Centers. We've now graduated over 1,000 people, and 70% of them have also earned a credential, some post-secondary credential that makes them more employable.
In terms of, that sounds like a significant expansion of what Goodwill was doing. How large a piece of Goodwill's, in any other context, I would say Goodwill's business, but that's not exactly Goodwill's activities right now. Is this educational component?
Right. It's a major part of what the organization is now doing. One of the things that we did, in part because as a result of the research that we did in 2008, where we were really looking at the links among poverty, low education levels, crime rates, teen pregnancy, and a whole host of health issues, and trying to say, how do we utilize our resources so that we can have the greatest impact and hopefully add some unique value in the communities where we operate? And we really came up with three. One of those is the historic role of employing a lot of people who don't have many options. Mm-hmm. We have over 1,100 employees who have disabilities, for example. We have over 300 employees who have been convicted of a felony within the last 10 years. That's a historic role. It's very, very important. But a second way now with the Excel Centers is to help older youth and adults who lack a high school diploma earn one and get on a path to some post-secondary credential that will make them more employable. And then a third way is to leverage our resources with those of others in the community who are doing some good things, where we can take complementary capabilities, put them together and help cause some good things to happen that otherwise might not happen. As a result of that, not only increase overall impact, but make better use of the total resources in a community. And that's an area where we think there's a lot of potential to do much more.
We are talking with recently retired Goodwill of Central Indiana President and CEO Jim McClelland. If you want to join the conversation, please call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Travis did. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. He says, great interview. Jim McClelland is a role model for all nonprofit directors. Congratulations to him on his retirement. So we probably ought to ask the question, retirement isn't an absolute thing for you. You're keeping your hand in here. We should make that clear that you're not disappearing. You're not headed back to Florida.
No, not at all. Indianapolis is home. I met my wife here. We were married here. Our kids were born and raised here. Our son is still here. He and his wife are. We're finally going to get a grandchild this summer.
No pressure on the other kids.
No pressure. But this is home. We've been so connected here and involved in things. I can't even imagine pulling up stakes and going anywhere else, maybe for a few weeks during the winter, but we'll see. I don't know what to call this except the next phase of my life, maybe the next chapter, because I don't fish and I don't play golf.
Mm-hmm.
And I need something that keeps, I think we all do. Throughout our lives, we need something that's going to keep the brain engaged, keep us active. Hopefully, doing something that's worthwhile. And I'm on a number of boards, and and hope to stay active and make some small contribution along the way.
How are you handling the transition, though? Because I can tell you're an organization guy. That sort of stuff matters to you. And, you know, one of the cliches is that there are really only two rules for a leader of an organization who is relinquishing the post so that someone else can take it. First rule is go away. The second rule is shut up, you know, because you don't want to be in a position where you're undercutting or, you know, after a long period. Yeah. How are you making sure that you're not casting a shadow over who follows you?
Well, I do have an office, but it's not in a Goodwill facility. And I basically am available to my successor as he might call on me, but I will not interfere. Now, if I'm doing something like this, mm-hmm. or if I'm invited to make a speech someplace, why I always clear those with him. And I'm trying to be very careful so that I don't in any way get in the way. That's not something that I would want anyone to do to me, and it's not something that I intend to do to my successor, who, by the way, is someone who has been with the organization for a dozen years, is exceptionally well prepared, and is going to do an outstanding job.
Was it hard to let go?
Not really.
Not really?
No, because I'd been thinking about this for several years.
39 years.
No, not really. You know, I'm a very lucky guy. I can honestly say I cannot recall a day in my entire career when I woke up in the morning wishing I didn't have to go to work. Not one day. Now, that doesn't mean that I was always, couldn't wait to get to work. But I never woke up wishing I didn't have to go in. I think that's when I consider what my 92-year-old mother told me a few years ago, was that my father, who has now been dead for 38 years, never had a job he liked. And I think how awful that must have been. The objective here is to perhaps utilize what experience I might have and some relationships and perhaps continue to be of some value for the organization.
What were the hardest? We're going to end this on an up note when we get to the next segment and talk about the successes and all of that. But what were the hardest days for you? I mean, 41 years, it's not an endless series of great days.
No, the best decisions that I made in my career were good hiring decisions. And the worst decisions I made were bad hiring decisions, which always had to be corrected. And when you get into a high-level personnel situation where you're going to have to do something that's going to be unpleasant for everyone, those are terrible. And nobody's going to be happy. I guess the other was, and some of the best moments and some of the worst moments of my entire career have been since we got involved in public education. And we had a student several years ago who was shot and killed on the streets. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty awful moment when you're doing everything you can and your people are doing everything they can to try to help improve and save lives in some cases. And in this case, it didn't work. And those are terrible moments. So, yeah, there's no job is fun all the time. I tell people, look, if the number of bad days ever even gets close to the number of good days, there's a problem. And you better see if you can figure out what it is and what you're going to do about it.
Real quickly, that is a horrible challenge, and it's made difficult also by the fact that you're the leader there. What did you tell your people on that day? Because that had to have just hit the whole organization like a hammer blow.
It did, but everyone also knew that we none of us knew what we might have done in addition to what was already being done. You do everything you can, and you know most of the time it works. And when it doesn't, you don't beat yourself up too badly, but you say you try to learn from it, and then if you can, take that experience and and hopefully be able to do even better going forward.
We are talking with Jim McClellan, who's just retired as president and CEO of Goodwill of Central Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Jim McClellan, who has just retired from 41 years as president and CEO of Goodwill of Central Indiana. He's also moved into some new roles there and is continuing to be active in giving voice to the mission of the organization. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Art, welcome to the program.
Greetings again. My question is, it sounds as though the Excel centers have proven that that model works pretty well. How transferable is that model to the general mainstream poverty school segment of Indianapolis, Central Indiana, or even as much as nationwide market? Is it possible to do school turnarounds? Can you take the types of material that, like this author, Paul Tuff, in the book, How Children Succeed, goes into exquisite detail about things that can be done to make things better. Can you take that, all the wisdom that's accumulating in the general education sector and apply it and maybe do a better job than the other people around?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Art. We'll try to get you an answer.
By the way, I've read Paul Tuff's book, and it's terrific.
He was a guest on this show, too.
It's a terrific book. The Excel Center model is... one of the things I think we have to remember is that every student who is there because they want to be there. They're there voluntarily. I think there are aspects of what we're doing that are transferable to other schools that are. There's some students who are going to thrive in this kind of a model, who might not in a more traditional. High school, for example. But there is enormous interest in the Excel centers from around the country, and they're getting quite a lot of national attention now. We have, we operate schools in Central Indiana, but we've developed a way that we've packaged the model so we can license it to other qualified operators in other parts of this state and in other states. The first Excel Center outside of Indiana opened in Austin, Texas last year with 150 students. They're going to expand to 500 students this year. There'll be one opening in Memphis, Tennessee this year. The Washington, D.C. Goodwill just got approved by the D.C. Charter Board for an Excel Center to open in 2016. And we're working with groups in several other states who would like to have this model in their communities. We are also quite interested in exploring relationships within the state of Indiana, where we might be able to others might be able to benefit from some of what we've some of the experience that we've developed and some of what we've learned. We designed the school to really fit the life circumstances of the prospective students, and. It's just worked extraordinarily well.
Do you consider that the most significant accomplishment of your tenure at Goodwill?
Yeah, it certainly is the most significant and impactful innovation that we've come up with. And if I had to choose any one single thing, I'm really particularly proud of, it is the development of the Excel Centers. If you look at it over the entire four-decade period, I guess the thing that I'm most pleased with and proud of is how the organization has managed to adapt and evolve as the world around us has changed, and of course everything has changed over 40 years. So it's a period of constant adaptation, but if there's one particular thing that we've done that I think is perhaps most significant, it would be the development of the Excel Centers. But, of course, that wouldn't have happened had we not had a lot of these other experiences along the way. One thing leads to another.
How did the nature of sort of the challenge of leading the organization change, evolve, you know, from the mid-1970s to, you know, into the second decade of the 21st century?
After the recession of the early 80s, I wasn't at all sure I was approaching my job the best way. I knew I needed to learn more. IU had an executive MBA program back in those days that was structured just perfectly for somebody like me, and I went through that program with a cohort of about 30 other mid-career people. All the others were from for-profit companies, most of them large corporations. And I learned a lot and came to the conclusion that we weren't as bad as I had feared we might have been, but we weren't as good as we needed to be. And then about a year after that, I woke up one beautiful spring morning having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And I was 43 years old and non-smoker. I've been a runner for 20 years, but the bad genes were more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And Goodwill did okay while I was out. But I vowed then that I was going to build a team that was so strong that if I did suddenly drop dead, the organization would just keep right on going without missing a beat for several months until the board was able to go through an orderly process to find a successor. And we started building a better team. And quite honestly, that made all the difference in the world because then with better talent in-house to run the day-to-day operations, I was able to spend more of my time on the long range, the strategic, the new initiatives, and we just kept building on that. So I guess if I could summarize a lot of this, it's you build a team. I just hired people who are smarter than I am, who can do things better than I can do them. Try to make sure they got the resources that they need so they can do what they're capable of doing. Try to make sure that everything is aligned toward an overall goal, and then just try to be helpful to them, and just keep learning. You never stop learning.
Was there, a heart attack is a significant event in a person's mm-hmm. life. I mean, it is, and for most people, there's a kind of stock taking that goes on in an episode like that. For many people, it's like saying, "Okay, I'm going to dedicate myself to good works." You were already doing that. Was there anything else you contemplated doing at that point, or was it all about, I just want to get back to Goodwill and I want to build this better team?
Oh, that was it. I never had any idea that I would do anything else because I loved what I was doing, and I just wanted to do it better, and I wanted to leave the org. I wanted to make sure the organization was not vulnerable if something did happen to me.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Ellen. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, ask Jim to talk about his and this Goodwill's influence on other Goodwills around the country, whether the use of paid advertising, opening schools, the nurse practitioner program, or his holistic view of moving his own employees along the continuum of self-sufficiency. Jim made innovations that are outcome focused that has made other Goodwills take notice.
Yeah, we get a lot of visitors here from other Goodwills around the country. Goodwills operate independently of each mm-hmm. other, but we do learn a lot from each other, and we learn from others. But we get a lot of visitors here, and in fact, last Friday I was speaking to the board of directors at the request of the CEO of that Goodwill. I was speaking to the board of directors of a Goodwill in another state
mm-hmm.
About how and why we have evolved the way we have, with a particular emphasis on our role in education with the Excel Centers, and so there has been I think a significant amount of impact. Goodwill up in South Bend is going to open an Excel Center this year. We're also going to be able to extend up into that Goodwill's territory, and this is a territory-based structure in Goodwill, the operation of Nurse Family Partnership, which is another program we we've gotten involved in that we didn't create, but we're implementing. It's a highly effective home visitation program for first-time moms in low-income households. And so there's some really good cooperative relationships developing with Goodwill up in that part of the state. I think that the holistic approach, it's been interesting to me when I go back and I read the early history of Goodwill to see that the first Goodwill, which was in Boston at the beginning of the 20th century, actually was working with people much more holistically than we have been in the last several decades. Goodwill in Indianapolis in the late 1930s was dealing with families, whole families, and in a much more holistic way. And I think really the change to more specialization began with the U.S. Involvement in World War II, and everything was focused on the war effort. And then following the war, perhaps in part because of the rapid increase in the education attainment level of the adult workforce as a result of the GI Bill, every aspect of our society started becoming more and more specialized. And we got better and better, smaller and smaller pieces. And I don't think in this arena, in particular, I don't think we did a good job of connecting the pieces. That's what we have to get back to, taking some of the good pieces that are out there, bringing them together in much more effective ways, and really starting to make a dent in some of these social indicators that, quite honestly, have gotten worse instead of better over the last 40 years. I look at Goodwill, and you know, you look at almost any metric, we're a very successful organization. But if you look at a lot of these major social indicators in that same period of time, mm-hmm. they're worse. We're spending more money and getting worse results. We've got to do some things differently. And I think the knowledge and the skills are out there. I just think we have to find ways to bring them together and utilize them much more effectively than we have.
What, of the goals that you had for the job, how many of them did you hit? And presuming that no one is perfect here, what was the great white whale, the one that got away?
I don't think there was any one, because we kept learning. And I used to, of course, years ago, one of my goals was to have 20 stores. Mm-hmm. Well, we went past that, and I said, well, maybe someday we'll have 30. And then we went past that, and I don't know what the limit is. We just keep looking for opportunities. With education, I never imagined that we would have what we've got. So this isn't the result of a grand plan that we brilliantly conceived. It's been an organic process. And a lot of that it continues to evolve. A lot of that is a function of our people. We got a lot of smart, talented people in the organization. It's the relationships that we have, that our people have with individuals and organizations, not only in central Indiana, but beyond, in all the sectors. And then I think part of it, too, is the culture of the organization, where we're constantly looking for better ways to do our work, ways to improve our impact. And it's a culture, too, where people generally work well with each other across departmental and divisional lines. So you take all this, and it's been pretty much of an organic process. So I don't think there's any one thing that I say, oh, I wish I could have done that. I did want to get through the last session of the General Assembly and make sure that we were going to have funding going forward to do what we want to do with the Excel Centers. And fortunately, we had a lot of support in the General Assembly to do just that. Now it's for others to take what we've got and continue to build on it and make it better and do things that I never would have dreamed of.
What will you miss most about the job?
The people. And working, you alluded to this a few minutes ago, working with a team to mm-hmm. accomplish something significant. Now, still, I know a lot of people, and hopefully we'll be able to do some other things that will add some value. But right now, I would say it's the people and just working with a team to a really good team to accomplish something.
What won't you miss about the job? You knew that was coming.
I have to be honest with you. I'm not missing the day-to-day operational responsibilities. You know, it's not that I ever didn't like them, but that's something that I'm finding that I'm not having to think about.
When you talk about day-to-day operation, yeah. what sort of things?
Oh, just the day-to-day problems that come up, and I haven't had to deal with a whole lot of that. But every once in a while, something happens that you gotta divert your attention from what you'd really like to be doing, and deal with something. Some of the routine stuff that every job has, you don't particularly miss those, but it's the people, what do you yeah. really leave? You leave behind people. You leave behind a culture, and we got a lot of good folks over there.
You've talked about how this is really now the next phase of your life and presumably your career. What are your goals for this next phase? You don't play golf, I know. You said that.
No,
you
I don't. I tried that, by the way.
Okay.
That's one that I failed at miserably. I've got a lot of material that I've written over the years, and I may want to do something with that. But
write a book, or
yeah, perhaps, and maybe consolidate some of this stuff that's out there into something that might be coherent and readable. I've found over the last couple of years, as I've had more opportunities to speak to college students on college campuses in Indiana and then Georgia Tech, where I got my undergraduate degree, I love the interaction with these young people. Quite honestly, a lot of them really give me hope. Got a lot of terrific young people working for us at Goodwill, and I've just really enjoyed the interaction that I've had with students on college campuses, students who are bright, energetic, eager to learn, excited about life, and you want to do good things in the world. It's not all about careers and money. They really want to make a contribution, and I hope to have more opportunities to do that sort of thing, doing a little mentoring with some individuals who have asked me to serve in that capacity. If I can take, at this stage of life, some of the experiences I've had, and it's not that I think I know everything, because I learn something new every day, but if I can do that and perhaps transfer some of that experience to others in ways that they might find useful and helpful, that'd be a pretty good way to spend the next few years.
Thank you for spending this time with us, and please do enjoy your retirement, Jim
Thank
McClellan.
You, Todd.
You have earned it. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for joining us. I am John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.